Imagine, just for a moment, that you are walking through an old library. It is the kind of library with high ceilings and warm wooden shelves and a stillness in the air that asks you to be quiet without anyone needing to say so. You move past the shelves slowly, your hand brushing along the spines of the books, and you notice something curious. On one particular shelf, an entire long row of cookbooks. Not one, not five, dozens, maybe hundreds. Some of them are thick and serious, bound in dark leather, with their titles pressed into the spines in gold lettering. Others are thin and bright and clearly meant for someone in a hurry. Some are written for restaurants, with quantities for 50 people at a time. Others are written for children, with cartoons in the margins and one recipe per page. One book is for someone who has only 20 minutes after work. Another is for someone who has been cooking for 50 years and wants techniques that take a whole afternoon. They're all, in some sense, doing the same thing. They're all sets of instructions for making food, but none of them looks the same as any of the others. Each one was written by a particular person, in a particular time, for a particular reader, with a particular kind of cooking in mind. You stand there for a moment, and you ask the obvious question, why are there so many of these? Why not just one cookbook agreed on by everyone, ending the whole centuries-long business of writing more? The answer is right there in front of you. There is no one perfect cookbook because there is no one kind of cook and no one kind of meal. The world of cooking is too varied for any one book to win. And so the books spread out across the shelves, each one finding its own readers, each one making its own trades between speed and depth, between simplicity and ambition, between the everyday and the special occasion. That same shape, that same spreading out into many different flavors, is exactly what has happened with programming languages. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 3. Why so many languages? Today I want to take you on a short, honest tour. I want to show you where programming languages came from, why we ended up with so many of them instead of one, and what trade-offs each of them is really making behind the scenes. By the end of the episode, you will have a mental shelf, very much like that library shelf, and you will know, roughly, where any given language sits on it. You will also know where the language we are slowly getting to know, the one this show is named after, fits into the picture, and why it ended up in the position it did. We will not write any code today. We are still building the shelf. Let me start with a thing that is genuinely surprising the first time you hear it. Programming languages, every single one of them, do not actually exist for the computer. The computer does not need them. As we talked about last time, the computer reads numbers in a particular order, and that is all. The numbers tell it to move data around, to do arithmetic, and to check whether one thing is bigger than another. That is the whole job. There is no version of the computer's life in which the words function, or variable, or loop mean anything to it. The computer has no opinion about those words. The words are not for the computer. The words are for you. A programming language exists because the human mind cannot easily sit down and write a long list of small number commands without losing track of what those commands are supposed to add up to. A human writing a recipe wants to say crack 3 eggs into the bowl, not move the value 42 from one tiny storage location into another and then increment a counter. The human wants to think about eggs. The machine only knows about its tiny storage locations. The programming language is the bridge between those two worlds. Now, once you understand that, the next question becomes very natural. If a programming language is for the human, then which human? Exactly. Because not all humans want to think the same way. A scientist writing a simulation of how heat moves through a metal rod wants to think about equations and grids of numbers. A web designer wants to think about a button on a page and what should happen when someone clicks on it. A bank wants to think about transactions and audit trails and what happens if a power failure cuts the system in half halfway through a transfer. These are all programs. The people writing them are all programmers. But the way each of them naturally wants to express their problem is completely different. This is the deepest reason we have so many programming languages. Each was invented by people who had a particular kind of problem in front of them and who wanted a set of words and a set of conventions that fit that problem cleanly. Each made traits. Each chose to be very good at one thing and accepted being merely acceptable or sometimes outright bad at others. Over 70 years of this happening again and again, we have ended up with a long shelf full of languages. The library shelf, in other words, was inevitable. The interesting question is not why there are so many. The interesting question is what each one is actually trading. Let me walk you through that question, because once you see the trade-off in plain terms, the whole landscape gets clearer. Imagine a single line drawn on a piece of paper. On one end of that line, we write the word fast. On the other end, we write the word forgiving. Every programming language sits somewhere along this line. The languages on the fast side give you the most control. They let you tell the computer exactly what to do in extraordinary detail, all the way down to the smallest moves. And as a result, they run extremely quickly because nothing happens that you did not explicitly ask for. But they are also the least forgiving. They will let you make mistakes, sometimes terrible mistakes, that the computer carries out faithfully, and those mistakes can be the kind of bugs that crash satellites or leak credit cards. The languages on the forgiving side trade away that control in exchange for safety. They put more cushion between you and the machine. They have helpful background processes like the cleaning service I mentioned last episode, the garbage collector that takes care of the boring and dangerous bookkeeping for you. They check your work as you go, and they catch many kinds of mistakes before those mistakes can cause harm. The cost is that they run somewhat slower, and they sometimes have unpredictable pauses, and you have less control over what happens at any given moment. But you can write programs faster. You can teach the language to a beginner in an afternoon. You can prototype something useful in 20 lines that would take 100 in a more careful language. Most programming languages live somewhere in the middle of that line, leaning a little one way or the other, depending on what they were designed for. Let me name a few with that picture in mind. Near the fast end, you have a language called C. It was created in the early 1970s at a place called Bell Labs to write a new operating system called Unix. And almost everything important and low-level in computing has been written in some descendant of it ever since. C gives you almost no protection. It says, you are a competent adult, you know what you're doing, here are the keys to the computer. It is unbelievably fast, unbelievably dangerous, and unbelievably influential. Its slightly younger sibling, C++, added more structure on top, but kept the same core deal. In the middle of the line, you have languages like Java, which came out in the mid-1990s to power a generation of enterprise software with a garbage collector and a careful type system that traded a little speed for a lot of safety. Further toward forgiving, you have Python, made in the late 1980s to be readable and pleasant. Python is slow by computer standards. It is also the most popular language in the world for data science, scripting, and machine learning, because the people who write Python code mostly do not care how fast the language itself runs. They care about how fast they themselves can think about the problem. JavaScript was invented in 1995 over the course of about 10 days to make websites interactive, and against everyone's expectations, it became one of the most important languages in computing. It runs in every web browser in the world. Go was created at Google around 2009 to write large server programs with a garbage collector and the cloud in mind. And then, at the very other end of the spectrum, sitting close to where C lives, but doing something fundamentally different, there is Rust. Rust is as fast as C. It has no garbage collector. And yet, somehow, it manages to be safer than any of the forgiving languages in the middle of the line. We will spend most of the rest of this show understanding how it pulled that off, because the way it did is the most interesting thing about it. Now, the line I just drew is useful but it hides something that becomes important once you have been around software for a while. Speed and forgiveness are not the only things a language is trading. There are at least three other dimensions that matter just as much, and that often decide which language a team picks for a particular job. The first is how quickly you can write something in it. Some languages let you go from idea to working program in minutes. Others make you spend more time up front, making sure your program is correct before they will even let you run it. For a quick experiment, that is an obstacle. For a piece of software that is going to live for 10 years and be touched by many people, it is a feature. The second is what kinds of problems the language has good tools for already. If you're doing machine learning, Python is where the libraries are. If you're doing low-level systems work, C and its newer cousin are where the libraries are. If you're writing a website that needs to feel snappy in a browser, JavaScript is where you live. A language is not just its grammar. It is everything that has been built around it by everyone over its entire lifetime. The third is the community and the conventions. Some languages have a single strong opinion about how programs should be structured. Others have a thousand styles. The conventions matter because the language you pick will determine what your code looks like 5 years from now after a dozen different people have touched it. Choosing a language is, in the end, less like picking a tool and more like picking a culture. You're not just picking the words you will use. You're picking the kinds of programs you will end up writing, the kinds of mistakes you will be protected from, and the kinds of teammates you will work alongside. There is no perfect choice. There is the right choice for what you are building, and the next right choice may look entirely different. And so, looking at the world today, you can see how that process has played itself out. Python sits at the heart of almost every modern data science workflow, and it powers the libraries that train the large language models you have probably been hearing about, including the ones that write code. JavaScript runs in every browser you have ever used, and in much of the back end of the modern web. Go runs much of the infrastructure of the cloud. C, 50 years after it was invented, is still inside almost every operating system in the world, including the one on the phone in your pocket and the one on the server that streamed this episode to you. And the language we are slowly approaching has, over the last 10 years, taken over a quietly enormous amount of the world's most demanding software, databases and query engines, web infrastructure that handles a trillion requests every day, the runtime that hosts every Amazon Lambda function, pieces of the Windows operating system, components inside Android phones, parts of the Linux kernel itself, which had refused to admit any language other than C for more than 30 years before it agreed to let this newer one in. None of this was decreed. No central authority told all of these teams to pick this particular language. They picked it because the deal it offered, safe and fast at the same time, with no cleaning service pausing the program at the worst possible moment, was a deal that simply did not exist before. The world's hardest software jobs needed that deal. As soon as it became available, the work began flowing toward it. That is how a programming language wins, and that is how this particular one is very quietly winning. We will get into the specifics of how soon, but not today. Three things to carry away from this episode. The first is that programming languages are not for the computer. They are for the human, which is why so many of them exist, each one designed for a particular kind of problem and a particular kind of person. The second is that every language makes a trade between fast and forgiving, between control and protection, between time to write and trustworthiness once written, and there is no perfect choice anywhere on that spectrum. The third is that the language this show is named after sits at a corner of that picture where almost nothing has sat before, as fast as the most aggressive systems languages, but safer than most of the forgiving ones in the middle, with no background cleaning service required. That is the corner we are walking toward, slowly, on purpose. Next time on Rust, gently, we're going to tell you the story of how this language came to exist in the first place. There is a person at the center of that story, An engineer with a side project and a frustration with the bugs he kept seeing every quarter at the company that paid his salary. There's also a company in a specific city with a specific problem that decided to bet on his idea and then send it out into the world for everyone to use. It is genuinely one of the better origin stories in modern software. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.